learning how to live and die. That's the bottom line, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Steph, let's stick the prayer up.
Yep.
So just think, it's so good to remember the words, to have it in our heart, not just chant mindlessly nice Tibetan tunes, you know. So two things, always just two things, say it every time. And the reason it's important, all these prayers, we tend to think, oh, it's just a prayer. Oh, here we go again, another prayer, boring, you know. But the point is, when we understand karma, that every millisecond of what we think, forget about what we say and do, programs us. So, of course, you want to say it as much as possible. It's like practicing push-ups. You don't just go, oh, here we go, another push-up. But this is the point. A push-up will bring a result. You know, you're programming your muscles. You're molding your muscles into the shape you want. Well, this is exactly what thoughts do. This is Buddha's whole amazing deal. Thoughts, every thought, that everything, thoughts are what create us. This is quite literally the Buddha's view. So we should be so excited to say these words, you know, because it programs us with that thought, with that tendency. How marvelous, you know. Whereas we're so bizarre in our culture, we say, it's only in the mind. I mean, we're demented, you know, we think it doesn't matter. It's the exact opposite for the Buddha. So we happily have these thoughts. So for those of us who feel we're already Buddhists, we reiterate our reliance on the Buddha. And I'll just say them in English in my words first, and then we'll sing the Tibetan. So we're saying, you know, until we are enlightened, we are going to rely upon the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha. And then we, our motivation, and now we think, so but you know, by listening, the virtuous karmic seeds we put into our mind by listening to these teachings, may we become a Buddha, so we can benefit every single suffering mother being. That's what we're saying. Sangye charang soke chognam la jantro baru dagmi kyab su chi dagi chanyen gipe sonam ki drola penche sangye drupa shog sangye charang soke chognam la jantro baru dagmi kyab su chi dagi chanyen gipe sonam ki drola penche sangye drupa shog. That's it. Okie doke. Okay, good. So, So what we're talking about, what we're doing is using Lama Zopa Rinpoche's book, How to Face Death Without Fear, that used to be called How to Enjoy Death. And there was another version of it that first came out, which was a PDF, which is called How to Help Your Loved Ones Enjoy Death so that they can go happily to their next rebirth. That was the long first title. So it's been through a few incarnations. But the current one, the paperback, which is also available digital and also coming out hopefully as audio. I'm in New Mexico and I live in Santa Fe and an hour north, I think, yeah. I always forget. It's Albuquerque, and that's where we found this man who's got an audio studio. So he does audio books. So we've done Mahamudra, and then the plan is, I have to remind Wisdom now, the plan is to do this book. Because it's so important. As I said yesterday, We're Buddhists, death is definite, I know that, blah, blah. But just like our friend, my friend, doesn't matter who it is, who is the one who triggered, whose statement to Rinpoche triggered this book, my father just died suddenly and I didn't know what to do. Because we don't like to think about death, it's too scary for us, you know. So as we've been talking, there's two ways of being getting ready for death, and the main one is live your life. Fine. I mean, Rinpoche, one of his chapters is, how to prepare for death by having a good heart. Basically, he's saying, you know, just you live a life of ethics. You live a life with a kind heart and you're a kind person and a good person. You have good ethics. You don't kill, you don't steal, you don't lie. And that means you've got a happy mind. That's what a happy mind is. A happy mind, you know, isn't coming from a pill. A happy mind is coming from virtuous thoughts. It's so simple, it's embarrassing. An unhappy mind comes from unhappy thoughts like depression and anger and jealousy and fear. I mean, join the universe. So having a kind heart, he says, that's the perfect way to die. It's the perfect way to die because you've programmed your mind all your life to be virtuous. So then you won't be afraid of change, whether you're a Christian or a Muslim or a communist. It doesn't matter. You'll die with a happy mind. It's quite clear because you've programmed yourself. It's sort of obvious. You've prepared yourself. You know, it's really obvious. You've prepared your mind. You can't suddenly have a happy mind overnight. That's why if a person hasn't practiced in their life, which is most people, that's why all the more they need you to help them navigate this experience. And you can help them conjure happy thoughts. But leave us to our own devices, we're a disaster, you know. We'll just be in total misery because at the time of death, as I said, and as Rinpoche points out, because of this process that occurs, this grasping in the 12 links, the ninth link grasping kicks in really powerfully, which is its nature then is to bring fear. Grasping onto something because you don't want to let go of it. You know, this is the function of attachment. So this is why, to understand why attachment is the main cause of fear at the time of death, we have to know Buddhist psychology, which is just logical. And also to understand the death, we have to know about karma. We have to understand karma and how it works, you know. And because we have the whole week, normally I do this course in a weekend, so I have no time, but we've got a whole week. Well, 4 days, whatever it is. We can talk a bit more about karma, I think. It's so important to understand. This is like the mechanics of Buddha's view, you know. We have to understand the mechanics. It's a really important point. And this is where, you know, if we look at the big picture in Buddhism, the entire path, as we call it, this path to enlightenment, this lam rim, basically it's a course. And on any course that you study, you graduate as something. So whether the course is a month or 25 years or several lifetimes, in this case, it's several lifetimes, you know, then you start at the middle, early stuff, you go to the middle stuff, you go to the most advanced and you graduate. It's pretty logical. And that's why it's so powerfully necessary to understand this packaging of the teachings. As we know, if you're a student of Lama Zopa, you just, every second word he says is lam rim, you know. So we hear it, but it's still very hard for us to process the experientially the meaning of that. And that's why I like to call it a course. That's what it is, a gradual path. It's a kind of quaint phrase, isn't it? It's a course. It's a course. And you know, a course, you go to junior school, high school, university, and postgraduate. I mean, it's the most perfect analogy. I use it all the time. It's so helpful. Because as soon as, if you say, as Rinpoche respectfully does, you know, the first level of practice in the Lam Rim are the teachings and practices suitable to the disciple of the least capability. I mean, that is quite a mouthful. Hang on. Excuse me. Sorry. Hang on, please forgive me. Okay. So, but if you say junior school, because we understand that concept, it's the basic stuff. Oh, I get it straight away. So I use this analogy all the time, you know. So here, in junior school are the nuts and junior school and high school, which is the wisdom wing. And then the compassion wing is Mahayana, Bodhisattva path. That's university. So junior school and high school is the lower scope and middle scope. It's such a good analogy. And that's the wisdom wing. And if you graduated there, you're on the Hinayana path and you would achieve, you'd realize emptiness and eventually you'd achieve your own nirvana. And in that particular life, when you die, you're out of here, baby. You're not going to come back. But, you know, if you're on the Mahayana path, you don't graduate there. You go on to high university and you add compassion to the mix. You add bodhicitta to the mix. That's the two Burmese two wings, you know. These analogies, I use them all the time. They're so tasty because they encompass the entirety of the path to enlightenment. Makes it very coherent. But the nuts and bolts of what a Buddhist is are in junior school and high school. Compassion, that's the Mahayana component. It's all the same work. You keep working on your mind. But it's fundamental starting point, the foundation of all the practices, the foundation, your ability to go to the compassion wing and practice. Is absolutely your ability, you know, you're having accomplished the wisdom wing. There's no question. As His Holiness says, compassion is not enough. You need wisdom. As Lama Zopa says, meaning well is not enough. It's a really good way to put it. Oh, I meant well. It's not, I'm happy for you. What about the poor person you're trying to help? You've got to have wisdom. And wisdom comes, even a relative level of wisdom. Don't fantasize wisdom. It sounds very noble. So wisdom just means being in touch with reality to whatever degree, you know. So what you're doing, one way of looking at what you're doing in the junior school and high school, in the first levels of practice, you're abiding by the laws of karma and you're working on your mind. So you're getting rid of the rubbish. So you're clearing out, you're removing the veils in front of your eyes so you can see things more clearly. That's wisdom. That's wisdom. We're living in la-la land right now, which is why we're suffering, Buddha says, because we're believing in all the nonsense stories of attachment and anger and jealousy and all the rubbish. That causes us to be just living in our own universe, making up our own stories, and we can't see people at all other than in terms of our needs. So by doing working at the junior school level, abiding by the laws of karma, and then purifying negative karma, this is fundamental. Then going to high school, the middle scope, and really unpacking and unraveling your mind. This is when you really become a Buddhist. These are fundamental things to understand in order to really understand this view of how to die well. And then how to help others, there's no question. Because as I said, you know, one of the key problems at the time of death, everywhere throughout our lives, but particularly the problem of death is attachment. And if we can't distinguish between attachment and love, then we're in big trouble. Like I mentioned yesterday, you know, I remember one course I did on this book, and the one woman at the course, you know, she was talking about how she, on the Saturday, she was talking about how she and all her friends were taking turns taking care of their friend who was dying, you know, and they'd have, because the woman liked Patsy Cline, so they had Patsy Cline music playing, her pets were in the room, her friends would come in and out, lots of talk and chatter, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then when she heard about this one about helping the person, you know, be peaceful and virtuous and not just clutter their mind full of rubbish, keep and try to take out people and things that attract their attachment or their agitation. So she came back on Sunday, said, when it was my turn, I turned off Patsy Cline, I chucked out the dogs and the cats, and then she died in an hour. This is how attachment works. It's very fascinating. Like I've been talking, you know, it's multifaceted, but one of the key functions of attachment in our daily life, like I said yesterday, is this never-endingly thinking, now this and now that and now this, we're anticipating. You see, because attachment, the energy of attachment is not satisfied with this moment now. It is not satisfied with this second now. So we look into the past and worry, and if only this and if only, and we look into the future, anticipating. That's the energy of attachment. That's the energy of attachment. And it's conceptual, all this blah, 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 this conceptual stories. And we get so excited. We're living in the future. Now I'll do this and now I'll do that. Now, all day is all we do. We know this. We call it living life. So if you're at least fortunate to have at least another person that you've got to feed the lunch to, there's some virtue. But most of the time it's just me and mine, you know. So we spend our life, now I'll do this, and now I'll do that, now I'll do this, now that, and then I'm this, and then I'm 20, and then I'll go weekend, and then we schedule our lives. Yes, you've got to make a plan. There's nothing wrong with a plan. But this attachment energy that just lives in anticipation of it. And you build up all the fantasy, and then when it doesn't turn out the way you want, you're devastated, because that's the way attachment is. It's a lie. So there you are at death, finally, primordially, in the bones of your being, because we've died a million lifetimes, and we just forgot. But it's the fear's programmed. It's beyond terror. There's no longer anything to look forward to. No wonder we hold on. So then the other function of attachment kicks in and we grasp at this like a vampire, unable to let go of it. So you fill the person's room with Patsy Cline and music and the dogs and the cats and all the people. You kind of got this fantasy. Oh, at least I've got something. I'm going to hold on to it. I'm holding. You're terrified to let go, like jumping off a cliff. That's the suffering at the time of death. So that's there normally. And then when the craving and grasping kick in, when this process that occurs throughout our life, the 12 links, but in particular occurs at the time of death, the craving kicks in about before you stop breathing, and then the grasping kicks in. It's back to about the second or third stage. I'll go into the stages of death now, then I'll keep referring back to it as we talk in the next days. So we have to be prepared for it. So this is where Rinpoche is so kind and says, this is the Bodhisattva approach. The first level of practice, junior school, junior school and high school, got to learn to get renunciation, give up attachment, give up the objects of attachment, give it up, train it, look at it, understand it, deconstruct it, unpack it. Now the Bodhisattva wing, we can be skillful and we can use attachment, because now we've plugged in the motivation of compassion. It's skillful means. So like I said, you know, talking to your Catholic mummy, she's dying and she's anxious and you know she's anxious because you know your mind. That's how you can help another person, because you know your own attachment. You know how it drives you. You know your mummy's mind, therefore, and that's how you can be wise in helping her. So again, the bottom line about the time of death, the bottom line is this is the point of Rinpoche's entire book, is to help a person be virtuous, having positive thoughts, not have negative thoughts. Don't think of it like being a policeman. You're naughty, you shouldn't have negative thoughts. Not like that. It's protecting the person's mind. Why? Because the logic is this. Check your own life. Check the last time you're feeling compassionate, kind, forgiving, loving, generous, immediately those states of mind, those conceptual stories, because they are valid. And a valid conception, one way to say it, a valid thought is one that's in sync with reality. And what's reality? Dependent arising, even relatively. You haven't realized emptiness yet, but check this. When your mind is virtuous, we don't like that word in modern psychology. It sounds like religion, so we get nervous, you know, but think of it. Loving, patient, kind-hearted. Immediately, there's no vivid feeling of a separate, lonely, bereft me, is there? There's a feeling of connectedness with others. And if you've got real love and compassion like the Bodhisattva, there's not even a fraction of a thought of I. You've done the job. I is now full. You're only for others. So the mind is naturally joyful. The logic of karma is that every millisecond, this is the big picture, every millisecond of any moment you have that is called happy, pleasant feeling, that is the fruit of a past karmic seed of yours, it could be 42 million years ago, of a virtuous action. It's a literal point. Every moment you can count in the day that you would label a pleasant feeling is the fruit ripening of a karmic seed of a virtuous action that's in your mind. And the various conditions trigger it and it pops up as a pleasant feeling. This is a literal technical explanation of what happiness is and its causes, past virtue. Yeah, the action, the person in front of you, let's say, you know, you're a person and your heart reaches out and you want them to be happy, that moment of kindness or love. The person's the catalyst. You know, you didn't have that moment of love until the person popped up in front of you. But they're just the catalyst. But you had the seed of virtue from past kindness in your mind and your active, the moment of seeing that person, and then the thought of, I wish they could be happy, that thought, that positive thought. Or they give you something and you're delighted. That's not the fruit of their giving. That's just a catalyst. That's the fruit of your past virtuous action. So it's literally our mind is full of all these seeds, trillions and trillions of seeds. This is the logic of karma, you know. And each moment that's called a pleasant feeling is the fruit of a virtuous seed. Each moment that's called an unpleasant feeling is the fruit of a non-virtuous seed. This is a literal technical explanation. And this is why we have to understand karma and we have to understand the second scope, which is high school, which is the way the mind works. This is the nuts and bolts of Buddha's view of the universe. So you want your mummy to be happy. And you want mummy to be less attached, less fearful, less grasping, less anxious. So this is why all these different chapters, what to think about, what to see, what to taste, what to touch, what to think about, what meditations to do, what purifications to do, all these different methods, endless methods, all of which, depending on your mummy and depending on what you think is the best thing for your mummy, could be one thing, will then activate your mummy's mind, make her calm and relaxed because she trusts you and loves you. You're like this anchor for her. This is your main gift at the time of death, including for your mouse, including for your little doggy. Your doggy adores you. Your doggy is holding on to you, just completely relying upon you. It's so precious, so special. You'll calm their mind down. Then you add the mantra to your little doggy. Plus you, your doggy will have a happy death. Even if it's got broken legs and you can't stand the pain, so you want to kill it. Don't kill it, please. Be kind and loving to it. Activate their own little peaceful mind. And then when the little doggy's mind can be relatively peaceful, that'll trigger when the time is coming for the karmic seed, which is number 212 of the 12 links. That's like I said, like putting your ATM card in, you put your password in, out comes the money. Well, the grasping is the putting the card in or putting the password in. And then that triggers number 2 link, the karmic seed among the trillions in the mind of that doggy or your mummy, that then is the one that will determine their next life. It's a technical process. So you better understand it. That's what's brilliant about the Vajrayana Buddhist view. They've got these amazing technical explanations. It's extraordinary, you know. So attachment is the killer at the time of death. So attachment looks forward to things. Attachment holds on to something. Attachment lives in a fantasy. Attachment, and that, you know, and it's a conceptual story that informs all the emotions that we have. So this is the point I'm getting at here too. The skill in the Mahayana approach is you can utilize the energy of anticipation of attachment by telling your mummy about how God loves her. She hasn't thought about God since she was 20, maybe, but because she's dead. You see, this is the thing, attachment's frantic to find something in the mind to think about. Look at your daily life. When you're distracted and bored, what am I going to do? I'll do this. I'll go for a walk. I'll have this. I'll do this. We never end. It's never stopping. It's never stopping for a second. Now, this is how you can use your daily life, how you can transform your daily life with attachment. We've all got attachment until you're highly realized. You've got to understand this. Until we're highly realized, until we realize emptiness, you virtually can say there's no one. Still, even you can take the semblances of attachment then. Attachment is primordial. So don't think, oh, I've got to give up attachment. You'll sit there going crazy watching your breath for 40 million years. It won't help. So on the Mahayana path, you be wise. And so you do virtuous actions. You help others. You help the Dharma Center. You do all the different jobs you're doing. Yes, attachment. It makes you excited. You're happy to do it. But how fortunate you are if you're using your attachment for something that's good. If you're going to use it, if you're going to have attachment, be attached to something that's useful to you. It's a skillful means, you know. It's really skillful means. It sounds almost shocking. It says, oh, no, you're not allowed to have attachment. Well, if you're wise, you can use it. Because it's a virtuous action, and you've added your bodhicitta in there. You wish to help others, or your compassion. You wish to help. That's why a person with a kind heart, just who does the dishes out of genuine kindness to help people. But there's attachment there too, because that's the action you enjoy to do. You know, attachment's there until we're highly realized. You can't pretend. That's why you have to understand it. So primordial. It's so multifaceted. So this energy here of attachment at the time of death is the holding on, terrified of letting go. So if you give them to something to look forward to, they can relax. It's skillful means. So they can think about God, think about heaven, think about how, you know, they're going to meet all your friends there, whatever words help your mummy. Instead of holding on now, I'm afraid of letting go of you, thinking about how bad she is, how guilty she is, and this primordial fear, this fear, because there's nothing to look forward to. You give us something to look forward to. It's using attachment. It's wise. It's a really important point. And you'll only understand all this if you understand what attachment is, you know, and that's the trouble. We don't. We just think, oh, I like chocolate cake. It's a bit more than that, I promise. So the whole point of the book is for ourselves, but to help our loved ones or the mouse or the dog or whatever at that time before the months and weeks before, and at the time, help them navigate that. And you're again, remember from what I said yesterday, your role is so powerful and you don't have to do much. Just your presence. When a person, like I said, when you're a little girl, I remember this so vividly. It's so powerful. When my mean sister said something to me, you make a beeline for mummy, if you have a mummy, you know? And you look up at your big eyes, as big as saucers, mummy, Janet was mean to me. And all she has to, her presence is enough to calm you down, you know? And then her words, it's all right, sweetheart. Oh, darling, it's all right, Bobsy. I was called Bobsy. And she'd give you a hug. And this is the part that's mind-boggling. She doesn't go and do anything. She doesn't make Janet do it. Oh, she might, but let's just forget Janet. She just says, it's all right, darling. And you believe her. That's how you help someone at death. That's how you help your dog. You just be there as a calm, steady presence and your doggy will calm down, relying upon you. They rely upon you. This is miraculous. Like I say, in the old people's homes, where everybody's just drugged out of their brains and there's no one helping anybody because all their children have rejected them or whatever. Just a cleaning lady, a kind cleaning lady sweeping under the bed who can look at you and smile and hold your hand and tell you you're a good person. This is beyond the most precious gift in the universe to make them feel okay. That's your presence. As Rimshin said, you can't stress enough that the importance of your role or the people who help at the time of death. You can make the difference for them, between whether a negative or a positive karmic seed is triggered at the time of death. It's like navigating a six-lane highway, you know. You're the person who helps them across, helps them navigate it without fear, but usually by helping their mind be peaceful. And the point is this, when their mind is peaceful, that means the space for virtue, because virtue and peace are intimately connected. Check yourself. When you're loving and kind and generous, you're peaceful. When you're angry and resentful and anxious and depressed, you're feeling like a nightmare. This is the logic in Buddhist psychology of the different states of mind. The negative ones and their nature neurotic and their nature fearful and their nature distressing. The positive thoughts and, you know, virtues in their nature are peaceful and spacious because they're rooted in dependent arising. I always use a simple example. Like I'm having a chat, like I mentioned yesterday, having a chat to whoever I have a chat to, whatever it is. Let's say Cherry. Having a chat to Cherry. And you can see from the distance our body language. We look at, oh, and what you'd say is using Buddhist psychology. Oh, look at that. They've got lots of love and compassion in their hearts. Look at them. You know, they're loving each other and they're having compassion for each other. Because that's the essence. Compassion is empathy with Cherry's headache. And love is Cherry's delighting in my happiness. Love and compassion are the essence of all the virtues. Such simple words, but so profound. You can see by our body language. Now, get my point. There's the compassion wing and there's the wisdom wing. And wisdom is related to reality. Wisdom is related, therefore, to dependent arising, because dependent arising is the way things exist conventionally. Interdependence. Check our body language. We are looking like we're connected, aren't we? You can see us looking at each other. So in a sense, you could say at that time, there's a sense of, because there's a sense of connectedness, there's harmony between us. We each are listening to the other. That means there's a sense of connectedness, a sense of dependent arising. I put it this way, there's a sense of we. And then look what happens when suddenly Cherry says the wrong thing or I say the wrong thing. The we is cut in half. You'll see our bodies jerk backwards. Suddenly the feeling of I, isolated, separate I, has come to the surface. Cherry, her little isolated, separate, oh, how dare you say that to me? No, how dare you say that? Then everything's gone berserk, hasn't it? Disharmony is running berserk, separate, oh, two separate eyes having a panic attack because delusions have arisen, because delusions are liars that are rooted in non-reality, separate, concrete, self-pity me. Virtues are rooted in dependent arising relatively. It's very powerful. It's really obvious. So reality means dependent arising, connectedness, interconnectedness. So when the mind is peaceful, it's because the mind is virtuous. That's all. That's the logic. When the mind is angry, it's not peaceful. When the mind is attached, it's not peaceful. When the mind is jealous, it's not peaceful. It's just logic. So your job is to help the person, whatever means necessary, to help them be peaceful. Now, we think in our culture, and forgive me, that pills will make you peaceful. Oh, look, she looks so peaceful. We just zonked her out on 14 grams of methadone, whatever you have to do. Not methadone, whatever it is. What's that one? Whatever it is. I forget. I remember when I used to get this weird kind of arthritic pain for about 36 hours. The Chinese call it wandering arthritis. I get these dramatic sort of dramatic illnesses that last a short time. It's most odd. And this one, I'd be in agony at 3 a.m. and have to go to hospital and have injections of steroids because the pain was so intense. You know, luckily it lasted 38 hours, 36 hours. I remember one time in Melbourne, my sister took me to her private hospital or whatever the hospital there, and they did all these 47 tests. And all I wanted was an injection of steroids and they wouldn't give it to me. So, I mean, they gave me not methadone. What's the other one? Morphine. They gave me morphine. And I was drugged out of my brain. I didn't know what we say in English. Oh, you are English. You know it. We say, we don't know whether you're Arthur or Martha. The Americans think that's very funny. We say, we don't know if you're Arthur or Martha. And we don't know if we're Arthur or Martha these days. We're completely confused. And we keep changing. Forgive me. And that was a horrible experience. I mean, I might have looked like I was all zonked out, you know, she looked so peaceful. No, I was not peaceful, I promise. My mom was completely confused, like total complicated nightmares, you know. So drugs will help the body stop pain, and it cannot help the mind. That is absolute certainty. And so the key thing, this is now just about the drugs thing now. The key one is, the main thing about death is to be conscious so you can help your loved one navigate it. You can be conscious. Try and be conscious. Best thing. So, you know, you have to make it, you have to sort of, you have to kind of work out the dip, you know, between too much drugs and not enough. The key one is to be conscious. And when you start to understand, you know, the mental suffering is one thing and the physical is another. They are really separate and we have to learn that in our lives. We don't learn that. We just assume if you've got a headache, of course I'm angry. Of course I'm upset, we say. We never realize we've got the opportunity to change our attitude towards the headache. That's the revelation the Buddha shows us. So death the same. When we realize you can help the person be peaceful and comfortable, even their pain is bad, their mind can still be feeling okay. And that's the practice we have to do throughout our lives. But we assume pain equals anger and fear. No, not at all. This is the revelation, you know. And it's the mental one that causes the most suffering. This is the one that's hard to imagine. Okay, if the physical pain is so bad, then sure. When it's just unbearable, you know. But still, you can see, with the high beings, like Lamazopa, when he got his stroke, he was even happier. Sounds too demented for us to even think about it. He was joyful because he was able to just take upon himself all the suffering of all sentient beings. It gives the bodhisattvas joy to think like this. It's hard to see the logic of that, but this is how they are, you know. And one story, this is outrageous. I remember Kirti Senja Rinpoche. I remember vividly at one teaching, talking about certain different levels of bodhisattvas. He said, for this particular level bodhisattva, the action of cutting off their hand and feeding it to a starving animal that action is as inconsequential as a leaf falling off a tree. That's pretty outrageous, isn't it? And that's because their mind, totally gone beyond delusions, realized emptiness with certainty and this unbelievable, unbearable compassion for sentient beings. In other words, I mean, clearly, if there's a butcher shop around the corner, they're not stupid. They go buy a pound of meat, okay? But if there's no option, there's a pound of meat right here. Hey, have this hand. And have the other one while you're at it, you know? This is inconceivable for us. But the only way to understand that is to understand the mind, how the mind works, and how delusions are what cause suffering. So when you've got not just, and you'd have to realize emptiness from that, and you'd have to have bodhicitta. Even if you realize emptiness, there's so much joy and bliss, you'd have a certain level of compassion, but, you know, not tremendous compassion like the bodhisattvas. They're like over-the-top compassion. So the delight in this, in the animal being free of suffering, way outweighs their any physical pain. They know there's pain. They can feel that the hand must be hurting, but the mind is so radically changed that the amount of physical pain is nothing. That's the point to understand. The mind is a billion times more powerful, and why we suffer when bad things happen is because of the mind. This is kind of shocking to hear. So, of course, we've got to be realistic about where we're at, you know. And this is why we misunderstand this. In the West, we say, you do all the tests. Sorry, there's no symptom of any illness. It's all in your mind. And that's the worst insult we can give somebody. That's not the way Buddha's saying it. Physical pain is real. But it's your interpretation of it that determines whether you suffer or happy. That's the point. You haven't made up. He doesn't make up. The hand is missing. That's a fact. But his view to it is dependent on what's in his mind. And the bodhisattva is full of joy. That action is as inconsequential as a leaf falling off a tree. I'll never forget those words. Okay, way to go. We're not there yet. But it's telling us the mind is the point. So when we can help the person's mind be happy while giving them drugs, fantastic. Now, this gets us to the point that's really important and so powerful, this one, is about the understanding of the subtle mind. So let's look at this. Let's look at the death process. But let's first look at this Vajrayana model of the universe, basically. It's the system that the Tibetan medical system uses. And it's incredibly delicious, you know. So according to this model of the universe, this is similar to the sutra practice, it's similar to the sutra, but there's a different way they talk, you know. There's matter and there are minds. That's it. There are matter and there are minds. There are trillions upon trillions upon trillions of mind streams, consciousnesses, rivers of mental moments, sentient beings whose minds go back and back and back and forward. It's just the nature of this. It's just how the universe is. And they're all experiencing different levels of happiness and suffering, all created by their own minds. And then they've got a physical energy. And this physical energy, this matter of the universe, is made of the four elements. Now, we talked like that 1,000 years ago or 800 years ago at the time of Mr. Galileo, probably, didn't we? In our Western culture, you know? But that's how still the Buddhists talk. It's not just some made-up thing. It's the actual reality. So why change it if it's reality, you know? You can have other levels of reality, different ways of interpreting reality. There's no problem with that. But this is the view they use. And there's the physical elements, the four elements. And this is the point. As Holmes points out in his wonderful book that's translated by Jeffrey Hopkins, it's been redone and it's now called, this is a really good book for you to read, it's a more detailed description of the death process based on a text by Panchen Lama. And it's called The Mind of Clear Light. And then the subtitle is something about dying. It used to be called About Dying, but the stupid publishers decided to call it The Mind of Clear Light, which is not much use to people, but never mind. But it's a really wonderful commentary by His Holiness about the death process, the same topic we're discussing here. So in there, as Honya says, according to this Vajrayana model of the universe, all minds are inextricably, this is just the way universe is, all minds are inextricably linked to their own set of the four elements. So we've got gross consciousness, which is sensory consciousness, basically. And that obviously is inextricably linked, contingent upon and linked to inextricably physical, the gross body. This is this bag of bones in our case, isn't it? You can't have eye consciousness. Eye consciousness, consciousness is the mind and it's not physical, but you can't have a cognition of eye consciousness without an eyeball. But we think in the West it's the eyeball that sees. No, it doesn't. It's got to be imbued with consciousness. So the body is the five senses, and that's imbued with sensory consciousness pervading our body. And then we've got the gross consciousness and gross body inextricably linked, dependent upon each other, contingent. Then you have the subtler level, which is called subtle consciousness. Now we don't even, I mean, we see the evidence of it in the West, but we don't know how to explain it. We experience it when we dream. This is mental consciousness. So we obviously, at the gross level, we are experiencing our mental consciousness, all our thoughts and feelings. They're all mental consciousness. We experience them at a fairly gross level. But in their nature, they're more subtle. So that's subtle consciousness. And that is also inextricably linked to a subtle physical energy, the subtle body, they call it. So that's made up of various components. Rinpoche talks about it just briefly in the book. You've got the subtle nervous system, something like 72,000 subtle channels throughout your entire physical body. Every inch of your physical body, because they're linked, you know, is your subtle, this is subtle nervous system. And coursing through those 72,000 channels are all these wind energies, wind or air, more subtle than the air we breathe, but linked, or prana in Sanskrit. And now, inextricably linked to all those wind energies coursing through your subtle nervous system are all your different states of mental consciousness, your states of mind. I mean, this is hilarious. This is no discussion. This is clearly not the same as neuroscience, this box up here, right? That's not being contradicted. It's just a different model. So you go to your Tibetan doctor. She'll feel your pulses. And she will feel immediately the imbalance of certain wind energies. And she'll know exactly that's related to your attachment. That's why you're having panic attacks or your anger or your jealousy. They'll recognize exactly. And they'll even know the karma. So it's the most holistic. It's the most holistic system you could find, the Tibetan one. It's totally rooted in the Vajrayana explanation of the universe and totally rooted in Buddhist psychology. Every wind energy is linked to its own state of mind. And every one of those is related to your health and your ill health. And then you take these herbal medicines, which they're still picking, all these herbs everywhere, you know, and you take the certain herbs that calm down the wind energies, which then impact upon the mind. Because these wind energies and the minds they're linked to are inextricably linked. Inextricably linked. And I always repeat this story, but it's in this quote from Rinpoche. He said, in the Kalachakra Tantra, there are these detailed descriptions of this intimate relationship between the internal and external energies, mind and matter, the winds. So when your mind even is just angry, that programs your mind with a tendency to be angry, karma, and it pollutes those wind energies, which in turn is what causes sickness. Every single illness of every living being is the fruit of their deluded states of mind and our past negative actions based upon those deluded states of mind. We create ourselves. It's the simplest way to put it, you know. It's a very fascinating view, you've got to admit. I love it. I mean, I think the idea of being the boss and creating yourself, I think it's the best idea I've ever heard. I don't want someone else running my life and keeping their plan in their pocket. Thank you very much. I love the idea that I'm in charge. We've got to get to realize we're in charge. The victim still thinks we're not. We love to blame everybody else. The other component of our subtle body is called, in Tibetan, tigle, these subtle red and white drops, kundalini. And Lama would always say kundalini because it gets Westerners excited when they hear kundalini, you know. It's just this name given to these subtle liquid energy, red and white, that comes from the parents. So when you conceive, when you go to your mummy's womb, and it's usually at the time of conception, it's usually, I mean, you hear different explanations, but pretty much it's at the time the egg and sperm come together, apparently in the fallopian tube. I don't know, there's different things you hear. It's at that time, usually, the consciousness, the karma ripens of the conscious. In our case, when we died in our past life, we left the body. We're going to go through all this process. We left the body, and then we're in this intermediate state, which is really like a dream state. I'm going to describe all this. And we're kind of, in a sense, waiting. It's in the, you're in the waiting room for your next life. So you're eagerly sitting there waiting for mummy and daddy to hop into bed because you've already programmed yourself. The karmic seed that will determine, in our case, that we go to our present mummy's human womb was already triggered before we even stopped breathing. We created the course to go to that mummy and daddy. We recreated the course to go to that mummy and daddy. We get the mummy and daddy we deserve. This is a very powerful point. Don't blame your mummy and daddy. Yeah, they might have been creepy. You created the course. I'm sorry. Or equally, if you've got a lovely mummy and daddy, it's not just good luck, you know, which of course is the view in the West. They made us. So of course we love to blame them. So, your very subtle consciousness, no, your subtle consciousness, which is in the intermediate state, and we'll describe all this, then mummy and daddy hop into bed, that's the catalyst, and you run like a magnet, and your very subtle you die in the intermediate state, and you go to your very subtle consciousness, which I haven't described yet. And I'll say that one. The third level of your consciousness, you've got gross, subtle, and now you've got very subtle. And the death process is this gradual deconstruction of all the gross, the subtle, all the way subsuming to the very subtle. And the very subtle consciousness, or it's known as the clear light mind, and it's the subtlest level of your being beyond which it can't be subtler, is inextricably linked with the subtlest level of your physical energy. And that's called very subtle body. It's not really body, but it's very subtle wind energy. And these are inextricably linked. They're like one entity, but they're separate. You can't, mind and body are not the same, but you cannot separate them. So these are the building blocks of the entire universe. Hell realms, God realms, human realms, based upon the actions you've created. And all the karmic imprints in our mind from all our past actions, nothing goes astray, are stored in this mind. And then when you leave the body, you're in the intermediate state. And then when mummy and daddy hopped into bed, in our case, when my mummy Billy, she was Agnes, but they called her Billy, Billy and Teddy, my daddy Teddy, hopped into bed, certain things happened, and the conditions ripened, and my consciousness left the intermediate state and ran like a magnet. And joined, the very subtle conscious joins this subtle red and white liquid energy, a subtler a level of the egg and the sperm. What we see is the egg and the sperm, that's the grosser level, but there's a subtle level, the red and the white kundalini, the red and the white subtle drops. That's all called desires, of course. One from the mummy and one from the daddy. And the second our consciousness joins that, that's the first second of Rabina. And then you start to grow, and that happens at what we call the heart chakra. So in this subtle body we're describing, you've got the 72,000 subtle channels. There's a central channel, which if the spine went all the way up to the top of your head, it would be just in front of the spine, which is towards the back of your head. And this is where the central channel starts and goes all the way down in front of the spine and ends at the penis, the tip of the penis for the boys and the cervix for the girls. Then you've got two side channels starting here that go up and then all the way alongside, running either side of the central channel, ending at the same place. And then you have all the other messy 71,998 channels, all very messy. So at certain points, there's a constriction of these channels here. And these are called the chakras. So people think chakras are these wonderful, delicious things. God knows what they think. But it's the constriction, actually. They're a hassle. They block the wind energies. And I'll explain what I mean by that. So up the crown, throat. You know, where for the boys, usually have Adam's apples. It's about there. Well, you know, when you want to cry, that feeling in your throat, that's the throat chakra. Your heart chakra in the center of the breasts. Your navel chakra, about, they always talk about, Tibetan Buddhists are very precise in terms of, you know, the way your mind works. And with the measurements, they're very vague. They talk about four finger widths, or they talk about an arm length. It's very funny. So four finger widths below your navel is where your navel chakra is. This constriction of different channels there. And then at the three secret chakras, outside on the penis for the boys and inside in the central channel for the girls. So these kundalini, these subtle red and white drops, when you, at the time of conception, when your very subtle consciousness, after it's left your previous, the intermediate state, after it's left the body, and you're programmed to go to that present mummy and daddy, and they hop into bed, and that's the condition, the egg and sperm come together, the very subtle, the subtle red and white drops come together, and then your consciousness joins that. And it's, you start at your heart chakra. That's the first moment of you, is when you start at your heart chakra. And then through, at the period of the time in the womb, the fetus grows, all from the heart chakra. All the bits and pieces grow, you know. So at death time, everything comes to the heart chakra. Everything comes to this heart chakra. And then when the consciousness, and so this red and white drop from the mummy and daddy are called this, in, they join together like a little tiny pea or tiny little kind of mustard seed, a seed, Rinpoche says. I forget what he says, a little seed. And there's a red top and a white bottom, very tiny. You can't see them with your eyes. And they, so the heart chakra, it resides there your entire life. It began at conception, and then you grew, all the grosser parts of your body grew. And at the time of death, you go all the way back to the very subtle consciousness and the very subtle drop. And your very subtle consciousness resides in that drop. So when you go through the eight stages of death and you get to that clear light, eventually that drop opens, and that second is the end of you. And that's the beginning of the intermediate state being. And that's when death happens, when your consciousness leaves that indestructible drop. But that's what started. And that red and white drop came from your mummy and daddy. So you've got the subtle body is the channels, the wind energies, and the drops. And then the chakras, this constriction of these channels. Then you've got, as I said, a very subtle consciousness, or extremely subtle consciousness, and extremely subtle so-called body, which is the subtlest wind energy. The subtle, and these are inextricably linked, as this holiness says. And this is the way the universe is. Every sentient being in the universe, it's like this. So this is where karma comes in. You know, a being who, due to negative karma, anger, jealousy, in anger, kill, especially harming, killing, anger, that's the most volatile one, the most harmful state of mind that brings the most harmful actions of sentient, harming sentient beings. When that karma ripens at the time of death, the being manifests as a hell being. So I find this very fascinating. We look at the world, you know, cultures all over the world. The Australian Aboriginals, who left there pretty isolated for 40,000 years, they come up with their own views about the universe. And the Christians and the Muslims and, you know, all everywhere you go and all the human beings over the centuries, we've come up with different viewpoints. And it would seem to me many have seen similar things, but we've got very different interpretations. I mean, you read the Catholics, you read the Muslims, you read the Buddhists, they're talking about the same thing. They all call it hell. We've got variations of their descriptions of it. I mean, you know, scientists are so arrogant. They just think all these people over the centuries have made everything up until we smarty pants came along and we've seen reality. I mean, the arrogance is beyond belief, you know. So shocking, the arrogance. So many humans have come up with the same things, but the difference is the interpretation, isn't it? You know, the concept in Christianity is there is heaven, there is hell, but God made it. There's no view like that in Buddhism. Nobody made it. The sentient being makes it. The sentient being themselves make it. They create the cause from their own past harming and anger. Their mind manifests as this intensely suffering being. And because our minds are inextricably linked with the four elements, then those elements will manifest in certain ways. So if you're in the God realms, which is the result of enormous virtue, your elements are manifesting as subtle light because your mind is virtue. So the karmic appearance is joy and bliss and radiant and divine. You've made it up. The karmic appearance for an animal is one thing, and the karmic appearance of a spirit, unbelievable, intense attachment. And there you could argue that their mind is conjoined with the air element. Well, the hell beings, their mind is conjoined with the fire element. This is logic if you understand the four elements. It's not some superstition like Lama Yeshe says, hell is not some place where the devil is waiting, saying, ha ha, I'm waiting for Lama Yeshe. That's a view of self-existence, that someone else made it and sends you there. That's a schizophrenic dualistic view. No, Lama said, not like that. It's the manifestation of that suffering sentient being's negativity. We create our own suffering, you know, and thank goodness we create our own happiness. And it's all understanding. This is understanding. This is helping us by understanding the elements. What's described in the tantras. This helps us understand how there can be different realms of existence. In the Lam Rim, they don't discuss this because Tantra comes postgraduate. In the Lam Rim, you learn it in junior school. There's no discussion about why and how. But I find this very helpful to understand how and why based on this model. In other words, how it's coherent and logical based on this model. we create ourselves. It's very fascinating. So anyway, the eight stages of death is this description of this gradual deconstruction of these components. So these eight stages, you know, it's even divided all the components, each of those stages of the eight stages, which I'll go into now, there's four or five things deconstruct. They're all together like 25 different components. So let's go through it in the book. I'll read it out. If you've got the book, you can, you know, share it with me. And learning to meditate on this is the key to success. And you link this meditation when you've done highest yoga tantra and you've taken empowerment. You link this meditation with your, as all the sadhanas are constructed in such a way that they combine with this eight stages. And you can practice going through this eight stages of deconstruction in your meditation. And this is exactly how you can learn to become a Buddha at the time of death. Rinpoche talks about this in the chapter called Death is What the Yogis Have Been Waiting For. It's very fascinating. So it's chapter 9 in part 2, how we go from one life to the next. Excuse me, always sniffing. Page 47 in my book. Okay, so these eight stages, the stages of intermediate death, intermediate state, and rebirth. So Rinpoche says, even though we go through all these eight stages at the time of death, what I describe here is a gradual death. As for how long the process takes, it's hard to say. In general, as I mentioned below, from the time that the first of the eight stages has occurred, it can be a couple of hours before the breathing stops. However, those who die violently or suddenly go through the stages very quickly. And sometimes in a violent death, the mind could leave the body immediately and go straight to the intermediate state. So in general, when the lamas teach this, it's kind of a fairly average type of death. You know, some people can go much longer and some people can, in an instant, you know, the mind can leave the body immediately and go straight to the intermediate state. And even then can even go straight to the lower realms because there's no waiting time to get an animal birth or a spirit birth or a hell birth. So it depends on the person and the karma and the way they die. So as I mentioned, as well as, and we'll see in chapters 10 and 24, the great meditators, those who have deeply familiarized themselves with these stages in meditation during their lives, can recognize the stages of death as they occur and can meditate on emptiness throughout. This is the key, and this is the practice that Rinpoche talks about in this chapter, which I'll go through for those of you who have got highest yoga tantra empowerment, and why in the end, according to this system, you need to have a highest yoga empowerment in order to get enlightened. Because this system, Lama talks about this in his book, The Bliss of Inner Fire, which I highly recommend you read. Lama describes this, it's a commentary on a text by Tsongkhapa, The Bliss of Inner Fire. As Rama says, Tantra is highly technical. This is completely linked to the tantric model. That's why also is Holiness's book as well. It's, excuse me, I never drink. He goes into much detail. And there's another book that I recommend that's published back in the 80s, also translated by Hopkins, Jeffrey Hopkins translated. It's called Death, Intermediate State and Rebirth by Lati Rinpoche. It's been out since the 80s. I don't know who publishes it now. I think Shambhala, I think. Snowline. Well, Snowline is owned by Shambhala now anyway, so. And that's a really detailed, much more detailed description of the eight stages. Very fascinating. Okay. Ordinary people, though, we don't recognize these stages. We go through these stages every time also that we sleep, but we don't recognize them too either. This is a really powerful point. The process of going to sleep is exactly the same process psychologically and physiologically as the process of dying, which is why we can try to practice at sleep and try to practice, you know, the great yogis can use their sleep and go through these eight stages. And this is the point. The greatest yogis who've got single-pointed concentration can go through these stages of sleep or, you know, literally without losing consciousness. They go to the from the gross to the subtle to the very subtle. The greatest, or even to say to the subtle, the very subtle is hard to get to. But they can go through this process practicing. And why, this is a good point, why is death what the yogis are waiting for? Because the level of subtlety of the clear light mind of death is way more subtle than the level of this, than the subtlety of the clear light mind, even in life of the greatest meditators. And certain meditators can do it, but it's just much more subtle. So it's the point they've been waiting for, because that is the subtlest level of mind. And why do they want to get the subtlest level of mind? Because that subtlest level of mind, because it's unencumbered by all the junk, has the capability of realizing all the realizations, removing all the obstructions and obscurations and obstacles in the mind, and becoming enlightened at that point. Because it's the subtlest level of mind. It's a technical point, not some mystical thing. So we have to, so this is one of the meditations, one of the meditations Rinpoche has put in the book is this meditation on these eight stages. And that's one of the meditations, you know, if your loved one is a practitioner, you can read these stages to them and they can just contemplate going through them, trying to remember them, because then maybe when it actually happens, this is the point, you might even recognize, you know, and be conscious and try to meditate on emptiness at the time. Of course, that's advanced for most of us because we're not conscious. So it's the same at death. You don't recognize the visions that occur at each stage of this evolution. First this, then that, now the clear light, now the intermediate state, and so on, because of the pollution of our ignorance and our uncontrolled mind. Even though we might know these stages intellectually, not having trained our minds in the meditation techniques during our lifetime and not having created enough virtuous karma or purified our minds, we can't recognize these experiences as they occur. But it's possible. And I discuss this in chapter 10. That's what we'll discuss later. So this is why Rinpoche says it's good to help your loved one meditate on these stages during the months and weeks before death. They can also become familiar with these stages as they go to sleep. And if they have a highest tantra practice, you can guide them through the stages of meditation when you help them with their daily practices. All of these are described in the book. Apparently, at the time of death of my past life as the Lao Dalai Lama, I don't remember this, a disciple was there to receive initiation and they were discussing the death evolution. It seems that the death process started while they were having this discussion. As I mentioned, I think in some of the older versions of the book, this is not there. Because with the latest version of the book, I asked Rinpoche many questions and he added many things. So as I mentioned in chapter 7, 25 components dissolve during these eight stages. So the five aggregates, they call these things, I'm going to describe, the five aggregates, the four wisdoms, the four elements, the six sense bases, and the five inner sense objects, 25 in total. Again, this is all technical, okay? So now the first one, all of these stages, these eight stages of death are all, they're labeled in terms of a subtle vision that occurs at each of these stages. And of course, which we don't, as ordinary people, don't notice, but these occur every time, but the greatest yogis can see these. So for example, when Geshe Lama Khonsong, this amazing yogi, and I'll talk about him to you, he's so amazing, special yogi, you know, he meditated for years and years in naked, no sleep, no food, in caves, 6 foot of snow in the winter, right on the border of Tibet, way in the other top end of Nepal. And he lived in Kopan the last 20 years of his life. He was very close to Lama Yeshe. They knew each other at Sarah J. And this great yogi, Lama Zopa, said he lived in Vajrayogini's pure land. This amazing yogi, you know, extraordinary being. And so, when he passed away at Kopan, he was with his attendant, Geshe Sopa. And at some point, Geshe Lama Khonsong, the mirage is happening. He said, go away, the mirage is happening. So he's actually conscious, he knows exactly. And he meditated for several days. This is the common thing for the great yogis. Once they get to the clear light mind, when you look like you're dead, they stay there meditating. And he was there for 3 days or more meditating at this subtle level. This is really common among the great yogis. So, okay. So the first of these eight visions, first these eight stages are divided into gross, subtle, and very subtle. And so the gross consciousness is the first four, the subtle is the next three, and the very subtle, or the clear light, is the eighth. So at each of these stages, several of those 25 components cease functioning. And in this list, it mentions each one. So the first is called the vision of a mirage. So if you think of what a mirage is, it's the interplay of earth and water, isn't it? So this is exactly the vision that occurs. And Rinpoche mentions the vision at the end of each of these pieces. So the first thing to dissolve is called the aggregate. So what are the aggregates? Aggregate is just, it's a pile of things. Buddha had a teacher, one of his sutras, he describes a person in terms of these five pieces, five aggregates, five components, way of dividing a person into these five. First, you could argue there's simply body and mind. There's two. Then what Buddha does is takes the body and mind. So that's the first one called form. All that means is body in the aggregates, okay? Just giving you a bit of extra background here. And the last one is called consciousness, which is just mind in general. Then the other three in the middle, two of them, form, feeling and discrimination. These two words you keep popping up in Buddhist teachings, feeling and discrimination. These are two of the 51 mental factors, which is a text, which is a way of presenting just 51. There's thousands of states of mind. They call them mental factors. We'd say states of mind. There's two of these that are crucial, that play a crucial role in the perpetuation of samsara, working with attachment. The feeling, which is either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral feeling. We'll go into this more maybe later. And then discrimination, and these are happening every millisecond, and they play a major role in keeping samsara going. Because, every time you meet an attachment object, it triggers a good feeling, and that's called happiness. And we all want happiness. So we cling to it and believe it's the cause, and so we keep doing it. That's the tragedy. And discrimination is this part of our mind that's happening every millisecond. That's the ability to distinguish between this and that every millisecond. So if you look around the room now, you can see a thousand things, and you can see there's a rose, there's a tissue, there's a fridge, there's this, there's gray, there's blue, second by second discriminating between this and that. And that's plays a major role in perpetuating samsara, working with feeling, working with attachment. So Buddha points these two out and gives them this special status. So it's form, which is the body, feeling and discrimination. The fourth one is called non-associated compounded phenomena. There's many terms, there's eight synonyms for impermanent, and compounded phenomenon is one of them. And so here there's non-associated compounded phenomena means all other impermanent parts of us that aren't the body and aren't the mind, or aren't the ones that have been mentioned so far. It's like this grab bag of bits and pieces left over, including the other 49 states of mind and all the other bits and pieces that are neither mind nor matter. It's details of stuff. There's no time to go into it now. So the five aggregates, they say, form, feeling, discrimination, non-associated compounded phenomena, something like that. And then finally, consciousness, the mind in general, they talk about. Okay, so the first of these is the aggregate of form. Your body becomes thinner and your limbs become loose and unmanageable. Then next one is this wisdom, these five wisdoms. It sounds a grand word, but it's simply the capacity of the mind to function in different ways. And so as Rinpoche says here, these and the other four wisdoms are labeled according to the function of the senses. So here, this mirror-like wisdom dissolves your ability to see many objects at the same time, as a mirror reflects many objects together. This ceases, and you cannot see the forms of people and objects clearly. Because at the same time here, as you see as the next one, the two further down, your eye consciousness is beginning to cease to function. So things get very muddy and vague. Now listen to this. We have this experience every time we go to sleep. And always remember, it's like if you're sitting there and talking to Steph and you're really tired and your eyes are open, you're sitting upright, and you suddenly feel very blurry. You can't see much. Everything can start to blur because this discrimination, this wisdom this wisdom called mirror-like wisdom is ceasing to function, and your eye consciousness is ceasing to go. So you can't see so clearly. We have this experience. So the third thing is the earth element ceases. Your body, you feel as if you are sinking. You might even reach up as if to hold on to something. I remember when I was living in India in the late, early 90s, I can't remember now, late 80s, maybe early 90s. And it was in Delhi in summer, and it's like 50, sometimes 50 degrees. And they don't have cool changes in Delhi, I promise. You know, it's just constant boiling heat with a blue sky until the rain starts. I'll never forget as long as I live. And I had hepatitis and malaria, but nobody noticed the malaria because I just was bright yellow. Until, I mean, I lost like 20 pounds of weight in 10 days. I was hallucinating. I was living in La La Land. Talk about not knowing if I was Arthur or Martha. And there was no AC in the house, in this little flat. I'll never forget as long as I live. Kirti Senchan Rinpoche said I was close to death. Well, you don't know you're close to death, do you? You just feel terrible, right? It was this most awful experience. I'll never forget it. Bright yellow, completely disgusting. These fevers, constant fevers, which you have with hepatitis. You have with hepatitis, but with malaria, you also have these fevers. But one person who walked in and saw me after the first week, she recognized immediately a malaria fever, you know? So no one had noticed the malaria. It was the most unbelievable experience. I can never forget it. And I just had to, I was hallucinating. I didn't know who I was or where I was. It was so intense. But I remember what happened was, anyway, with that long story, blah, blah. I remember my kind sister, Janet. I knew I had to get out of India. I knew I would die, you know. I had the feeling I had to get out of India. So luckily Air India let me fly. I was bright yellow, right? It was very funny. And then I remember my sister, Janet, came from Brisbane to fly to Singapore halfway just to pick me up. It was incredible. And I got to Singapore and we had a hotel overnight with air conditioning. And I'll never forget it as long as I live. This is the bliss of this air conditioning. I'll never forget. But I had the feeling of my body sinking. That's what I'm saying. Even then, after I'd still been on the plane, then I had this feeling of the body sinking into the bed. Obviously didn't die. I'm still here, alive. That's one of the signs, you know. It's like when you're tired. Your body's like a lump of lead, isn't it, when you're tired? Because, you see, all the elements are ceasing and all these energies are, you see, all these wind energies, when you're wide awake and wound up, all the winds are coursing through all the central, all the channels and all the states of mind linked to those channels. Everything's bright and sharp and you're all perky and bright and everything's crystal clear. But as you start to get tired, what's happening is the winds are beginning to leave the extremities and leave, and the earth is ceasing to function, the air, or you know, the different senses are ceasing until eventually everything subsumes to the heart chakra. All the energies come to the heart chakra eventually, but by the eighth stage, everything's gradually deconstructing, deconstructing, deconstructing your mind and your body. So this mirror-like wisdom dissolves, the earth element dissolves, and then the eye sense base. Okay, the way they describe in this view of the mind in the sutra teachings, you've got eye consciousness, which is your mind. Then you have that there's a subtle physical energy. They call it the sense bases. We don't talk that way in our culture, but they say that's there, a subtle. So that this earth element, that's what they call it, the elements or the sense bases, an element, earth element. Now, so the earth itself, the element ceases, and then the eye sense base ceases, dissolves, and you can no longer open or close your eyes. If your eyes are open, they'll remain like that without blinking. This is a sign that you will die within 1 or 2 hours. In fact, this is the nearest sign of death. So this is what happened with Lama Yeshe during the last couple of hours before he passed away. He was unable to close his eyes. I talk about this in chapter 24, and I've seen it in other dying people. So as the inner form, so they talk about this also, which we don't talk about, the inner form dissolves, your body loses its strength completely and it loses its radiance. We can see this in dying people who die slowly, sick people, you know. So now you'll have a vision of a mirage, an inner vision, like water shimmering in the heat. Your vision blurs. Everything seems watery and wavy, like a mirage in the distance. So that's what Geshe Lama Kontrak, he was conscious because he's a great meditator all his life, you know. He saw it coming. He could see. He was conscious at that level. Most of us, this happens every time we go to sleep. But who remembers this? You know, nobody. We just wake up 6 hours later, you know, unconscious. So there's various components. Aggregate of form, the mirror-like wisdom, the earth element, the eye sense base, the inner form, and the mirror, and then there's a vision, right? That's the first stage. The next stage is the vision of smoke. Excuse me. Vision of smoke. As the aggregate of feeling, this next one, feeling, and this is needs, okay, there's no time to discuss here. We'll discuss it later, maybe. Dissolves. You can no longer experience the three kinds of feeling. This word feeling is really important. In fact, it's vitally important to understand in Buddhist psychology. When we say the word feeling, we use it to mean an emotion. You know, it's not the way it's used here. In fact, when you look at the Buddhist model of the mind, you've got three categories of states of mind: the negative, neurotic, ridiculous, I-based, suffering ones, the valid, reasonable, appropriate, virtuous, you know, useful ones. And then you've got what they call neutral, which means neither virtuous nor non-virtuous. But neutral doesn't mean they're not important. That's why I like to call them the mechanics of our mind. They're vitally important. They enable us to function. But they're neither good nor bad. It depends on what you use them for. So concentration. A sniper needs really good concentration. They need really good discrimination. Think about it. They need really good mindfulness. Mindfulness, we put all these bells and whistles on it in the West. It's just ridiculous. You know, it's not the meaning what Buddha gives it at all. What Buddha's meaning is this ability to not forget what you're doing moment by moment. That precisely is what mindfulness is. The ability to not forget what you're doing moment by moment. We need it to do anything. Well, the sniper needs it. As Lama Zopa says, thieves need mindfulness, you know. These are the neutral states. These are neutral meaning, I like to call them the mechanics. You need them badly to function. So feeling and discrimination, by the way, both fit in that category. So, okay. So here now, this capacity to distinguish between feeling, there's only three kinds of feeling: pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. Pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. So pleasant is another word. Pleasant feelings is another word for happiness. But we so conflate happy feelings with the thing out there that triggered it, don't we? We think it's the same. When you talk about your happiness, you talk about the thing that happened. When you talk about your suffering, you talk about the thing that happened. That's not happiness. That's not suffering. It's the mere catalyst out there that triggered pleasant and unpleasant feelings in your mind. This is a hugely important point to get. Unbelievably powerful to understand this. So here, you can no longer experience these three kinds of feelings. They kind of all dissolve, you know. The wisdom of equanimity, another one of these types of abilities to see things, which sees these three together as having the same nature, dissolves. I don't understand that one. I always try to work out what it is. I have to find out. Then the water element dissolves, which sees the liquids in your body dry up. Your mouth feels very dry. This too is a sign that death could be within 1 or 2 hours. Now the ear sense base, this subtle energy, dissolves, and you can no longer distinguish sounds. Now look at that. I'm talking to Steph. I'm still sitting upright. My eyes are open, and I lost the last 20 seconds of what she said. We all have that experience because we're beginning the process of this deconstructing these elements, and before you know it, you'll topple over, you know, when everything goes. We all have this experience. The inner sound, you know, that inner sound dissolves. You can no longer hear even the buzzing in your ears. And now you have the vision of smoke, like a room filled with incense or smoke from burning green wood swirling about, Rinpoche says. So now your dying thoughts activate the karmic seed that determines your next rebirth. As the Bhogo Rinpoche says in Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand, your dying thoughts activate the karma that will be the cause of your next rebirth. And the activators of this throwing karma are the 8th and 9th links, craving and grasping, like I've mentioned, discussed in the previous chapter. Rinpoche says that this takes place while the mind is still active and you can still recall virtue or be reminded of it by other people. This is the crucial point. At this point, it is so important to be able to control the arising of the disturbing thoughts by remembering the guru, the teachings, renunciation of samsara, karma, emptiness, loving kindness, great compassion, or God, if the mummies are Catholic, whatever it is that suits their mind, you know, which gives us the chance to be born in a Buddha's pure land or to take a perfect human rebirth. If our last gross thoughts, because as the mind is starting to go, you know, are virtuous about this point, the throwing karma will be virtuous. So what happens is, you know, the 12 links is this process that occurs every single second of the day. And it's a description of how we create rebirths after rebirths after rebirths after rebirths. Quite this technical explanation. So number two is called karma. Every single second, we have a thought, intention, that leaves a seed. We create a karma. And there's a whole series of the whole series of conditions that are there that enable the seed to be planted in the mind. And this is the main seed in your main bank vault, which are the ones that will produce future rebirths. And one of this, at this point in the death process, this is before you stop breathing, when you still got your wits about you, about this point is when this grasping, the ninth of these links, kicks in very powerfully. And that's the trigger. Like I said before, it's like putting the ATM card in, put your password in. That's what triggers the number two, the karmic seed in your bank vault of billions of karmic seeds over countless lifetimes. And the way you die determines which of those seeds is triggered, you know. So you want a virtuous seed to be triggers. You want one of their non-killing karmic seeds practicing them. As Lama Zopa says, you know, the main cause of a human body, in our case, getting a human body, is the past action of non-killing, but practiced in the framework of keeping vows of non-killing. In fact, Rinpoche says, just being good is not enough. We'll describe all this more. So important. So the time of death about this point is when the grasping kicks in, even though it's still intensely suffering. If you've practiced and you've got a person there helping you navigate it, the grasping is the trigger, but your mind can, you have to listen to, think about your Lama, hearing about his name, hearing the prayers, your friend being there just with you, then your mind can, you know, and that grasping is still grasping, but it triggers the number two link. And if your mind is relatively virtuous on top of that grasping and you're hearing positive things, that enables a positive karmic seed to be triggered. And that's when you get programmed for your next life. In our case, in our past death, that's when the karmic seed was triggered that programmed us to go to our present mummy's human womb. So you can obviously deduce too that at the same time, kind of like we've got four bank vaults. One is the main one, which produces a type of rebirth. But the others are the three residual results left over from past actions that then ripen within this life. One as our tendencies in our mind, our goodness, our badness, our love, our compassion, our kindness, our being good at football, whatever it is, our actual tendencies in the mind, they're called actions or intentions or tendencies similar to the cause. They're basically a bunch of habits. You didn't get them from your mummy or daddy. It's very shocking to hear that. They're your past habits. It seems to me at this point, when the karmic seed for us in our case, in our past life, that was triggered, that determined we go to our present mummy's human womb, the next lot of karmic seeds that were triggered would be the tendencies in the mind of that person, which is who the person we are now. So Hitler has got a human body. That was the fruit at his time of his past death. One of his virtuous karmic seeds of his main bank vault was triggered. He got a human body. But then look at his tendencies. Mother Teresa's got a human body as well. But look at the second way that karma ripens is their tendencies, and that shows the difference. Your tendencies, your mental tendencies, they're your past habits. They are triggered at the same time. The third lot that are triggered would be the third kind of karma is called experiences similar to the cause, which is the way you're seen and treated by others. We're social beings. Look at us. We don't live in isolation. We don't, you know, we live in relation to others. We get a birth by relying upon another person. We need a daddy's sperm, a mummy's egg, a womb. Then we have siblings and aunties and uncles, and we have the rats and the cockroaches, and then the next door neighbors and the people at school. Our world is pervaded by sentient beings. We have this strong history with all these sentient beings. So how they see and treat you, simply speaking, is this third kind of karma, experiences similar to the cause, experiences similar to the cause. Which cause? Your cause. And karma's personal, I'm sorry. If this is a natural law, then it can't be random. But we all think it's random. We think it's all good luck and bad luck. I mean, we're so demented, you know. It's not random. How can it be? It's a natural law. Whoever you meet, however they treat you, whether it's the rat or the cockroach or the person who gives you $100 million, they're your karmic appearance, baby. You've got karma with them, and you know the relationship between you is related to the way you've treated them in the past, and how they treat you now is a fruit of that. This is karma, good and bad. But unfortunately, we only remember the bad. And the fourth way, that fourth bank vault we've got with all the karmic seeds in it is called environmental karma. The way the very physical world, we don't live in the sky, we all have a physical environment. The way the physical world impacts upon us, that too is the fruit of our karma. So the main cause of you getting a human body, your past actions. The main cause of every tendency in your mind, your past actions. The main cause of every way that sentient beings see you, treat you, harm you, love you, hate you, your past actions. The main cause of the way the physical world impacts upon you, your past actions. You're the boss, babe. All of these things must be triggered at the time before you stop breathing. You're already programmed. Now, as Rinpoche says, if your last gross thoughts are virtuous, the throwing karma, is that this is the one that triggers this, the main seed that caused your human birth, will be virtuous. If the last gross thoughts are non-virtuous, the throwing karma will be non-virtuous. The karmic seed that ripens is whichever is heavier, more strongly habitual, which, as I mentioned, could have been planted 100, even millions of lifetimes ago. If they're equal, the seed that was planted first will be the one that ripens. It's a logical process, you know, and no one's running this process. There's nobody up there pulling the strings, which is the view we have as a boss somewhere, like a conspiracy theory, nothing like that. If we die with anger, let's say, or strong attachment to our life, our loved ones, and so on, our birth will only be in the lower realms. This is just a natural process, because if negativity, if the main cause is negative, let's say an anger is in the mind, you freak out, it triggers one of your negative seeds. And if the main throwing karma, if it's negative, it can only bring the results, hell life, spirit life, or animal life. That's the only options. This is Buddha observation. And this is based on the Buddhist view of the mind, because these realms are just manifestations of the mind, you know. So at this point, five things can occur. Let's say if a negative seed has been triggered and the throwing karma is negative, which in our case from the past life, it wasn't that. Five things can occur. And people who are around dying people, they concur with this. You know, if you're dying with non-virtuous thoughts, though not all five will necessarily happen, you shit yourself, Rama politely says soiling yourself, your arms and legs thrash about, screaming, blood coming from your ear, nose, mouth, your eyes rolling up. And if we have created very heavy negative karma, all five will happen. And as we are dying, we'll have terrible visions of our future life. We'll feel that we are moving from light into darkness. Many people talk about that you see people freaking out like they're seeing, literally they're having a hallucination. It's because, you see, what's happening is because your mind is getting, your grosser mind is ceasing to function. And this is exactly the same as what happens when you go to sleep. Many people, so as you're going to sleep, you know that. And then you wake up in a dream, don't you? A dream is your subtle mind. So when you're dying, it's the same thing. Your mind is becoming less, more and more subtle. And so because your mind is becoming more subtle and because the karmic seed that will determine your next life has been triggered, you're literally able to see your future life coming. It's literally you can see it coming because your grosser mind is ceasing. And because subtle mind has the power to be clairvoyant. So that's why some people who have very vivid dreams, you can't even distinguish between the waking and the sleeping state. The dreams are so vivid, they're able to access their subtle mind really easily. That's your subtle mind, and it's more capable than your gross. The gross is limited because we live in conceptuality and our senses are dominant. Here your senses are less dominant and your subtle mind, your mental consciousness is more dominant. So that's why as you're dying, if it's a virtuous karmic seed, it's like, as Rinpoche says, it's like going towards the light. They say that in the text. On the other hand, dying with a virtuous state of mind causes us to have a peaceful and happy death. In fact, if we're like the best spiritual practitioners, we will be joyful at the time of death. I mean, that's literal. It happens naturally. You're not choosing to be joyful. It's because the virtuous karmic seed has been triggered. And as your mind's getting more subtle, you're seeing your future life coming. Could be the Pure Land, could be the God realms, could be a human birth. A friend of mine died, Australian fellow died, well, not a friend of mine, one of our fellow students of Lama Zopa Lama Yeshe, back in the 70s. He was at Vajrapani Institute in California, and he was working on the roof, and he fell off the roof, and he's dying and he's in his wife's arms. And she said he was radiant. He was joyful. Means a virtuous karmic seed was triggered. And as he's literally dying, his mind's getting more subtle, and he's literally probably maybe a Pure Land. He's seeing a Pure Land. So his mind is radiant. I always tell the story about how Steve Jobs died. I love this story. I love Steve Jobs. I remember hearing about, I read one of his biographies. I read one of the memoir of one of his daughters from a previous marriage. And this made me very happy. There's a Rinpoche, a Brazilian lama in San Francisco. I can't think of his name. Segui Rinpoche, I think. I know him. He's a friend of mine. And he's been recognized formally by Lati Rinpoche as a Rinpoche. And he's a healer. He's an amazing, wonderful human being. And he's got many students in San Francisco. So apparently in this memoir by the daughter of the previous marriage, she went to visit her daddy one day and he was there. Segui Rinpoche was there. I was very happy about that. Some karmic connection with Dharma. Anyway, whatever, this lovely experience. His sister, they'd both been given away at birth, and so she met him later in life, and then the family gave her permission to talk about this at the memorial. She came on the day he died, and she's sitting there, and if you can try and visualize, in front of me, I can see Steve's face. I'm the sister, right? And Steve's in front of me, but between me and Steve's face is his two daughters, and they're looking at him. So I can see the backs of the daughters' heads, and he's looking at the daughters. And she said he's looking. He was radiant, full of love, you know, full of joy, and begging them to forgive him for leaving them. In other words, not attachment, not grasping and freaked out, joyful. Then she said she saw him. He looked over their shoulder into the distance. And he went, oh, wow, oh, wow, oh, wow. And then he died like that, very quick. So that means he went through those eight stages very quickly, or the first four. And as his mind got more subtle, his mind must have been so virtuous that a virtuous karmic seed was triggered. And let's hope he was seeing a Pure Land coming. You know, because when you read the things that he talked about and all his talks and everything, he was really in touch with impermanence. You could really see it. And his mind was very joyful, very peaceful somehow. That's a perfect way to die, you know. But he died very quickly, like that, from being sitting upright, conscious, and suddenly the virtuous karmic seed was triggered because maybe so much virtue in his mind. You'd have to deduce that. And he literally is like seeing a Pure Land coming, blissful, and then he just fell down and died. I love that story. A friend of mine in Queensland, a nun, a Sakya nun, she sits with the dying, and she told me one time, one story. Hang on, my computer's running out. Well, it's time to go.
Yeah, I was just about to interrupt you.
So I'll tell you the story. Yeah,
that's fine. Just to let you know where we're at with time.
Exactly. I forgot. Thank you so much. So, okay. So this lovely story, she said that, she said this one fellow she was sitting with, he wasn't a Buddhist. He suddenly had this, he that's like Rinpoche talks about non-virtuous karma. A non-virtuous karmic seed must have been triggered. And he had this, he turned into a monster. His eyes rolled back on his head, everything was red. He was screaming like he was seeing the most monstrous thing you could ever imagine. But then he calmed down and then he seemed to die peacefully. So she asked one of her lamas, he said, well, it seems like very heavy negative karma was triggered first. He purified it and then a virtuous karmic seed was triggered and the karma changed. And the karma changed and he died peacefully. That's interesting. And Rinpoche said, I told Rinpoche that story. And Rinpoche also mentioned that he knew somebody. I can't remember. It's in here somewhere. Person like that, you know. So this is why also, if you know this system, you'll understand. If you see your loved one freaking out or looking radiant, you'll know why. And you'll know what to do to help. That's the point. As Rinpoche said, this is education we all need. So we have a break now, people. And we'll think of your questions and we'll get some questions later. So we've been through, we're at the second, the third stage, we're at the second stage of death, okay? Thank you, precious ones. Jam Chob Semtog Rinpoche, Ma Ke Panam, Ke Guchi, Ke Panyampa, Me Payang, Gom Ne Gondu, Pelva Shog. All right, sweethearts, see you in an hour, okay?
Thank you, Rabina. Thank you.